every dune is different. If you are walking up towards a dune and you've just crossed 500 before, and you think, oh, well, what could possibly be different about this one? Well, every single dune is different. And you get up to the top, and that natural human curiosity to see what's at the top, whether it's a mountain or the top of the roof or the top of the next dune, it's a very cleansing freedom. And that's why I like to walk down and climb up the next dune. Yeah.
Andrew Harper's business card says that he's a desert walker. I've never met anyone who can claim that as their primary profession. This is Off Track on RN, and I'm Anne Jones. Andrew Harper is the founder of Australian Desert Expeditions and the leader of the last desert walking camel cavalcade in Australia. He leads ecologists, ornithologists, archaeologists and all sorts of other professionals, as well as lay people, through the desert undertaking wide-ranging surveys. At the moment, he's in the middle of a three-year project centred around a transect of the Simpson Desert. It's a line drawn on the 138th meridian. Andrew Harper was in Sydney recently and I asked him to come in to talk. He stood out among the students running through the ABC building on their way to class and the workers with their coffees with lanyards around their necks. He's a man out of place in the city.
I don't relax here at all. Yeah, and you know, I'm lucky enough to spend, you know, 5 months in the desert where there is no noise. Well, having said that, there's a silent noise, that makes sense. And yeah, but I get blown away by what goes on here. I don't know how people relax. I guess I don't. I mean, we take people on our trips who have never sat around a campfire and who have never been where there's no streetlights. And that, I just think, good heavens, or haven't been where there's no mobile phone or anything. And you can see them change. You know, you can. It's quite amazing. You know, it's fantastic to watch. And just the whole body clock and everything just resets itself. It gets, you know, sets with the dawn and the dusk and the sunrise instead of lights and all the rest of it, you know, which is nice. Yeah. I think that's why so many people come back.
So how did this desert walking begin?
Well, I'm from the bush. So I grew up in the country in Deniliquin, and I've spent my working life as a jackaroo or an overseer in the stud merino industry. So it was a natural progression for me and a natural step to have a look over the fence and go further afield out into the desert. I thought, well, I don't want to drive. I don't want to ride a motorbike. I want to walk. And that's why I ended up learning about camels. And then it was a natural progression from there. Well, maybe not that natural, but a progression from there about exploring the desert physically in the purest sense by walking, accompanied by pack animals, and also mentally by being out there away from stuff.
But as a young man, young men often are drawn to quad bikes, helicopters. I mean, we all are. I mean, they're fancy equipment, aren't they? So what did your friends say?
They weren't surprised. I don't think my family was surprised either. I mean, you know, I'm a creature of the 21st century, like all of us. You know, technology amazes me. I think it's incredible. But coming from the bush and the country and working on the land, there's a connection there that can never be severed, for me anyway, and I think for a lot of other people. So all those machines that you mentioned are fantastic and they have their place, but it is so good to be able to keep them in their place and go back to, you know, how we all used to get around, walking.
So why walk? How does your experience differ from those who four-wheel drive through the desert?
Oh, it's totally different, totally different. When you're walking, you have to see where you're putting your feet. So consequently, not only are you looking to see where you're going so you don't fall over, but you don't miss anything. You see everything and you see the story of the desert literally written in the sands. So you see what happened the night before on the sand dunes with the little tracks, the hopping mice or whatever it might be. And you see the artifacts about who lived there before, both Indigenous and European explorers and prospectors and stockmen. So that's the key difference. And you're outside. Well, I should rephrase that. You're not outside. You're just that's the day. You know, there's no difference between inside and outside. So when you're in a four-wheel drive, you're seeing the desert, you know, you're passing through, looking out a window, like traveling in a train, you know, and looking at the landscape whiz by. But when you're walking, there's no thing about being inside or outside, or cold or wet or damp or night or dark. It's just out there. You know, that's the day. And after a while, you don't think of it as in terms of, you know, gee, I'm cold, or, you know, wouldn't it be good to get there quicker in a vehicle? It just doesn't come into the equation, because you're experiencing everything. You're not traveling through the desert. You're actually living in it.
There is a logistical element to this, though, because you wouldn't be able to stay out there for that long if you didn't have your camels.
That's right.
So why camels?
It comes down to camels being superbly adapted for where we work, which is in the deserts of Australia. So that roughly 18% of the mainland, that's where the 9 or 10 true deserts are on the continent. And camels are perfect for that. Yes, they are not native to Australia. Technically, they're a feral animal, a feral species. And along with all the other disastrous introductions of feral animals in the country, it would be better if they weren't here. I'm the first person to say that. However, they are here. So let's try and utilise them in the best way possible. So that's how we do it, by using them as pack animals. And that's a tradition that goes back to, you know, Burke and Wills 155 years ago. Also, being a stockman, my background, you know, I love working with animals, whether it's horses or sheepdogs or whatever it might be. You know, working with camels is a delight. And they have a very much undeserved reputation as being aggressive and cantankerous and what have you. But I know some good horses that can be the same way.
So do you have to take fodder for them, and they just nibble along the way?
We don't carry food or water for the camels. So they live on what's out there at the time. And that's, of course, why they've done so well. As the original Afghan, in inverted commas, cameleers knew when they had to release their camels early last century, that they would survive, and they have.
So what is Project 138?
That's a part of what we call our Central Australia Transect, which is basically drawing a line on the 138th meridian, which is the Queensland Northern Territory border, as you know. And we have drawn a line on the map stretching from about 80 kilometres north of Lake Eyre in South Australia through the Salt Lake system of the Simpson Desert Regional Reserve up to Popal Corner, and then continuing north all the way up to the top of the Simpson, more or less, onto Cravens Peak Reserve. And Project 138 is the concept of looking at the Simpson Desert in that 400-kilometre corridor and just asking, well, what's going on? What's going on with the Simpson Desert over a three-year period out there? And when I say what's going on, we're looking at, you know, the flora and fauna, the birds, the plants, the animals, the reptiles, the mammals, the marsupials, soil carbon analysis, and also looking at, you know, what Aboriginal artifacts are out there, who lived out there before, what did they leave behind, how did they live, how did they die, everything. Because, of course, all of that is connected. So that's what Project 138 is. It involves a lot of national research institutions and universities, as well as our own ecologists and scientists. And we spend 4 to 5 months every winter out there.
They're incredibly broad brushstrokes, though. And often these days, science and scientific surveys can go very specific, taking in very specific sites and targeting very specific species. So what does your approach actually offer science?
The first thing I probably should say is that where we're surveying hasn't been surveyed before, because it's bloody hard to get to. You could drive to some areas, but that only tells you what's going along on a track. You know, we want to know what's going along 700 metres or 80 kilometres or 20 sand dunes to the west, you know, where no one walks anymore, and especially where no scientist or ecologist has walked and surveyed. The current research in the Simpson Desert is concentrated on the particularly eastern desert fringe, and also to the south, just above Lake Eyre, on private conservation areas, and right up in the north on some private land management areas. And that works very well, but that's 5% of the desert. We need to know what's going on in the other 95% so we can put the 5% into context. So the data that we collect gets collated with existing research projects by institutions like Sydney University, Bush Heritage Australia, Australian Wildlife Conservancy, etc. And that's why what we do is very important, because it gives their scientists and research something to look over the fence at, so to speak.
Looking over the fence and into the Simpson Desert today on RN's Off Track. I'm Ann Jones, and with us in the Sydney studios is Andrew Harper, the leader of a series of expeditions into the Simpson Desert focused around the 138th meridian.
We take scientists and ecologists who have basically approached us, who have been doing this existing research on the desert fringe, and they say, okay, can we do a project and see what's going on out here? And they can come from anywhere. You know, we've got an open door. There's no problem about that. Also, we have another segment to our organisation, which is a volunteer ecotourism segment, where members of the public can pay to volunteer to come on our surveys and work alongside the ecologists and scientists in the field, get their hands dirty, and, you know, help them dig pitfall traps or document bird sightings or whatever it might be. That could be anybody, as long as they're fit and healthy and can walk and are prepared to live out there 24 hours a day and learn about the desert, learn about the ecology of the desert, what's making the Simpson Desert tick at the moment, and also learn about the cultural heritage of the Aboriginal people who used to live there, and also the European heritage of the camel strings, because we're the last desert walking string of pack camels left in the country. You know, so we're the last living link to a 155-year heritage. So, and people find that very fascinating. That's in itself, let alone the desert ecology.
There may be artists even. There's all sorts of people that come along. But what stops this from just being a sort of nostalgic reenactment of expeditions gone by, of Victorian expeditions?
There are expedition artists, that's right. And you might think, well, why bother? You know, we've all got a camera. Why do you need an artist? It's important because artists see with a different eye. An ecologist will be taking a photo of a landscape specifically focused on a plant or that particular frog or those birds or whatever. An artist will see the whole thing from a more neutral perspective and will pick out the detail that necessarily we hadn't noticed before. And it would be easy to say, well, you know, this is all great, you know, fluff and bubble. You know, we've got this great heritage string of camels and we're going out there and we're doing this and doesn't this look fantastic? But when you're out there, you realise that, you know, hardly anybody walks the Australian desert for prolonged periods anymore. And when we're out there, you realise that it's important. You know, the desert should be walked. And I'm not speaking for my sake, I think for the nation's sake, really. We need to be out in this huge expanse of Central Australia, the heart of the country, walking the country, finding out what's going on. We need to collect all the information about what's going on, and we need to use that for further land management. So it has its nostalgic side, you know, sitting around the campfire, all of that. But in many respects, that's just the way it is. That's not nostalgia. That's life out there. It's not invented camping. It's not invented ecotourism. All of this was happening long before ecotourism was ever invented, you know. And if you look back at even the Burke and Wills expedition and the other great exploring expeditions in Western Australia, Finlayson in the Northern Territory, Warburton and Giles, Michael Terry, you know, their data is still being looked at because it's become benchmark data of what the desert was like then compared to now with Europeans and invasive species. And what we're collecting now is providing another set of benchmark data.
The breadth of the data is huge, as is the distance and the landscape within you actually operate. And I'm actually wondering how you manage to come across anything.
It's a good question, because it's a big space. In the context of the Simpson Desert, which is around about 180,000 square kilometres, stretching in the southeast corner of the Northern Territory and Queensland and South Australia, you'd think, well, how on earth do you run into anything there? In the Simpson, we know where people lived. You know, there's a network of native wells, which is what we're working on at the moment. There's the ephemeral watercourses, Eyre Creek, the Mulligan, the Callacooper Creek, Macumba River, the Warburton, where people lived. So you will always be able to document and find things along those areas. Having said that, last year we were working in part of the desert in Northern Territory, and it was a deliberate survey to look at what was going on between the wells in the thoroughfares that people used to walk on many, you know, at least over a century ago. And we documented and found artifacts there that I wasn't expecting. And by that I mean the number and the actual physical size of these things, which was fantastic. And you might think, well, how did you find that? And it comes down to looking. You're looking to see where you put your feet. As an expedition leader and leading the camels, I'm looking to see which is the best way through the landscape. And I will inevitably choose a way over the dune or through the patch of Gidgee or whatever it might be that is easiest for the animals that any other person 100 years ago would have chosen the same route, or any explorer with his camels 150 years ago would have chosen the same route. So we have camped on areas where I know explorers have camped because I found things on the ground, and I think, well, it's the only way these things could have got there. So it's just about looking, you know. And when you've got 12, 15, up to 20 people spread out over 200 or 300 metres looking on the ground, that's the best possible way to find out, you know, what's going on. And again, this is why it's so much better than driving. You know, when you're driving, you're looking at the steering wheel and you're looking out the windows to the front, left and right, but you're not looking at the ground. So you miss so much.
You've mentioned the Aboriginal wells. So who are the traditional owners of this area?
Where we're working at the moment is the Wankanaru people, who are essentially based in Birdsville, Boulia, Western Queensland. So we're talking about the Simpson Desert in the very west or southwest of Queensland, Mungatiri country, which means big sandhill country, aptly named. And there are a system of native wells or mikkari, which stretch across the Simpson from South Australia, more or less where the South Australian Northern Territory border is, up to Popal Corner, which is where the three states meet, and then diverge across to Eyre Creek on the eastern side of the Simpson. And that allowed people to go across the desert in good seasons and dry seasons because they knew there was a system of wells where they could get water. And these are wells that don't look much. They're not what we would call a well in the European sense of the word. They might be just a slightly shallow excavated depression in the ground that, of course, was maintained, and you might have to, you know, remove the sand with your hand and eventually you'll get some water. Or others had a small tunnel that led down under the limestone plateau where usually a thin or young male or female would crawl down and bring back some water. And some of the wells were much bigger than others, and there was a substantial population, when I say substantial, a number of dozens of people who would live out there for extended periods. And some of these wells were connected with the pitchery trade, which in pitchery is the native narcotic, which grows only in certain areas of the Simpson. And we're working on that to try and rediscover exactly where. But that was an important trade for the Wankanaru people, in some respects one of the only things they had to trade. So we're working on the native wells, and what I mean by that is not so much the wells themselves, because we know where most of them are. We discovered or rediscovered one back in 2004, which had been sort of lost, and we're working on a couple more this year and next year, because in some cases they haven't been looked at by archaeologists or anthropologists to document these sites. Because if you can paint a mental picture for a minute, when people left these places in 1902, 3 and 4, they thought they'd come back, you know, in the next good year. There was no reason for them to think they wouldn't. But of course, they didn't. They left the desert for whatever reason and they never came back. And some of these wells are like, you know, time capsules, I suppose you could say. And it's important that they be documented for the national interest, let alone the Wankanaru people.
Well, what about their involvement? Are they involved actively in your expeditions?
Yes. Yeah, they are. They're actively involved in the planning, and we have their blessing to go out there and document these areas whilst their elders are still around to contribute to what we find, to their knowledge and their stories of the desert.
On Off Track today, we're not actually outdoors, but we're hearing from a man who spends much of his life outdoors in remote Australia, leading expeditions of scientists and eco-tourists and a string of camels to walk Australia's deserts. In fact, earlier this year, he received an OAM for his services to environmental science, research and adventure tourism. Thousands of kilometres of desert in Australia, and you've traversed a lot of it. Aren't you afraid of death?
No, not at all. You mean out there or in general? No, not at all. No. And maybe that's a blokey answer, but no, never crosses my mind. I mean, I've been lucky enough to do quite a few solo expeditions, but, well, they're never solo because I'm with my camel, so you're never alone. With any expedition, whether it's by myself or with one or two other people or being responsible for 20 other people and 20 camels, you plan every single thing, and the essence is in the planning, to the point where once you leave and get out there, that's the easy part, because you know that you've got a backup plan and another backup plan on top of that for every single eventuality that might come your way. So accidents, which can happen, of course, you know, we're all human, but things like death or fear, it doesn't come into it, especially fear. I've been asked that before, you know, don't you fear the desert? Or, wow, no, because you're in charge of, you know, it's just you, you know what you're dealing with. If anything, if I was coming to the city where there's so many variables and people coming at you from you know, a thousand different directions and everything happening around you, not that I'm fearful of that, but that's when you don't have control. That's when things can happen. But when you're in the desert and you've put all this together and you're confident about what you're doing, you have the experience and the expertise of yourself and those around you, and you're prepared for things that may go wrong, yeah, it's fine.
But how do you make that transition from 5 months a year in the desert to back to, you know, what other people would call real life?
I don't. I now consider real life to be the desert. I find it very hard to come back because I've just spent 5 months living outside, away from phones and emails and all that stuff. And even though there's a fair degree of logistical capability in it, but putting that aside, you know, when I do come back from the desert every year, it's a really great shock, not only physically, because you've just been walking anything up to 3,000 kilometres. So, you know, you're at peak performance, but you're mentally cleansed. You're on a very peaceful level. And you come back to be sort of bombarded with things. And what fascinates me, though, is it's like being a visitor in your own country. And you come back to see what the rest of Australia's doing. And you look at a newspaper or you turn on these televisions and you see what the country's preoccupied with and the rubbish it's preoccupied with or the pettiness. And it might sound very cynical, I know, but it is something that really does hit you. It's like, good heavens. People are obsessed with cooking shows. How did this happen? You know, you just think, wow, oh, people, come on.
At the very start of this interview, you mentioned a change in people who have gone out walking the desert with you. Just how did they change?
I think they become better people. They certainly become more relaxed because you're taking them out of usually an urban environment, because that's where most Australians live, with all its accompaniment of digital connectivity, and you're cutting that off. You're stripping it back straight away. So everyone sitting around the campfire, everyone's the same. It doesn't matter whether you're an executive from a big company or whoever. It cleanses people. And also just simple things like your body clock gets realigned. You know, you wake up with the first light, you go to bed with the last light. And I think that's a really good thing. I know when I come to the city, I get thrown skew with because, you know, you stay up later and I'm not outside. And I think just being outside, being able to see the horizon, it just sets you as a person. I don't consider it work. You're walking with the camels, you're looking for a way up, and you're talking to them, you're talking to people around you. you're walking as people have done for tens of thousands of years. You know, you're just part of the landscape. And you have some animals with you. And you get up to the top. And it's a very cleansing freedom. It's, I think it's just a feeling of purity.
Well, I feel a bit sheepish trying to tell you to go to the website and listen to more podcasts after that, but there you go. Andrew Harper, our guest today on Off Track. He's a desert walker with Australian Desert Expeditions. The website, if you're interested, is abc.net.au/rn/offtrack. I'm Anne Jones, and wear your walking shoes again next week and meet me here at the same time. That's when I'll take you somewhere else.